On this episode of Skeptico, guest host Steve Volk discusses paranormal science reporting with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Deborah Blum.
And we end up being thrown back again, and I think this is one of the hard things. You know, who do we believe? Who do we trust? I want to see somehow people in the middle pick this stuff up and look at it, but that's a very, very rare occurrence.
I agree. Like I said, I'm a mainstream science journalist and daughter of a chemist. But what was fascinating to me when I started working on ghost hunters is that I'd go and give talks at different universities. I mean, literally, I was at a university in Florida, and they said, oh, let us tell you about our haunted laboratory. Or I was at a meeting with a bunch of animal researchers, and I was sitting next to a very respected scientist from Stanford who immediately started telling me about the telepathic experiences she'd had with a friend of hers who's a scientist at a Southwestern university. And I thought to myself, this whole world exists that really those of us in the Dr. Skeptics community never see because people just don't tell you that.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. And on today's episode, as you just heard, there's a new voice behind the interview. So before we get started, I thought we'd take a minute and introduce that voice, that being the voice of journalist and author Steve Volk, who's joining me right now. Steve, hi, and welcome to Skeptico.
Alex, thanks for having me.
So I love this interview that you have for us today. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and why you wanted to talk to today's guest, Deborah Blum?
Well, she had gone down a path before me that I'd wanted to go down myself and ultimately did with my book, Fringeology, which doesn't come out till June. But the issue is that for me is that I've always covered traditional topics in journalism. I started off covering music. I was a music critic, and I ultimately veered into writing lots of narrative nonfiction about politics and crime and the courts and just, you know, traditional journalistic subjects. But what was always sort of at the back of my mind, it would be raised from time to time when something would sort of bubble up in pop culture that would make me think of it, is this family ghost story that I had grown up with, that there was supposedly a ghost that had haunted my house when I was a kid. And I had some memories of it myself. And I just felt like as a reporter, though, that subject was taboo, that I couldn't cover it for the obvious reasons that you always get into on the show. It would undermine my own credibility to even entertain the idea that such things as ghosts exist. And over time, though, I started realizing that when we talk about paranormal subjects, we're really talking about the big existential questions that people find themselves asking at 3 a.m., right? What does it mean to be human? Who are we? Is there life after death? Is there a God? All these kinds of issues, you know, are we alone in the universe, come up through paranormal topics, whether it be UFOs or telepathy or ghosts. And so I'd really admired Deborah Blum because here she is, you know, a Pulitzer Prize-winning science reporter, where the taboo against covering these sorts of topics would be even stronger. And yet she went for it. And she covered, you know, William James and the scientific search for the afterlife in her book, Ghost Hunters. And so I just felt like I really wanted the chance to sort of visit with her and see what her motivations were.
Great. Well, I really, really enjoyed the interview, and I think all the Skeptico listeners will as well. You are planning on doing a couple more interviews for us as well, which is terrific. Can you tell us what you have planned coming up?
Well, Dr. Andrew Newberg, the neurotheologist who studies the neural correlates of religious experience, is going to be one of the next couple of interviews. And there are a couple other people that I'm talking to, including Amy Hardy, who has agreed to be interviewed, but we haven't yet been able to schedule it. And she is the documentary filmmaker who recently released the film The Edge of Dreaming, which is, again, her, you know, in her experience in life is a bit like Blum's. She made scientific documentaries And then she had what seemed to be a prophetic dream. And she went ahead and followed that path and made a documentary about where it led her.
Well, that sounds great, Stephen. I think people are really going to enjoy getting to know you and getting to hear from these folks. Sounds like some great interviews you have lined up for us. But now, let's get to your interview with Deborah Blum.
Today, I'm going to talk to science journalist and author Deborah Blum. Blum worked as a science writer for the Sacramento Bee and has since written for the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, Discover, Health, Psychology Today, and Mother Jones. After completing a master's degree in environmental journalism from the University of Wisconsin, she wrote about a broad range of science-related issues, from superconductivity to the physics of weapon systems. She won her Pulitzer in 1992 for her writing about primate research, which she turned into the book Monkey Wars. And since then, she's had a great run as an author. Her current book, her fifth, is The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York. But she is joining us on Skeptico to discuss Ghost Hunters, William James and the Search for Scientific Proof of Life After Death, which was first published in 2006 and remains available today. As I believe you'll see, that book and Deborah remain very much worth our consideration right now. In Ghost Hunters, Blum weaves an intricate and compelling narrative out of the formation of the Society for Psychical Research in both America and England. She paints the backdrop in artfully. The turn of the century is the 1800s bleed into the 1900s, and those who believe in God and the Creator and life after death try to deal with the science of evolution and the philosophy of materialism that has come to dominate academic and intellectual circles. In Ghost Hunters, Blum details the efforts of the great psychologist and philosopher William James and a small but influential and accomplished gang of scientists who had the courage to operate outside the mainstream scientific paradigm and investigate mediumship and whether or not there might be life after death. I highly recommend Ghost Hunters, and we'll talk a bit about the content of that book, but the main reason I wanted to bring Deborah on Skeptico is to talk to her about her personal and professional journey as a science writer and why she decided to step outside the mainstream paradigm herself for journalists and address a topic like the search for the afterlife. Because the stigma against any sort of paranormal research isn't confined only to scientists and philosophers and academics. The taboo, I think, exists for reporters, too. And I read a bit in my own book, Fringeology, about, in a sense, sticking my head in the lion's mouth and outing my own experience as the youngest son in a family that told an incredible ghost story. And how, as a reporter, and Deborah, I'll be interested if you feel the same way about this, I was taught, without anyone giving direct advice on the subject, taught by observing how it's done, that the way to treat any paranormal topic in print, if at all, is with a kind of gentle, learned skepticism, to cover it, let's say, with my tongue in my cheek. Fringeology is my attempt to break all through all that, to overcome the taboo and write a book that takes the paranormal seriously. And of course, Deborah, Ghost Hunters was your attempt, and in my estimation, a very successful one. And so I'll start just by asking, what were you thinking? What was it that led you, with your background, to take on this topic of science and mediumship for a book?
That's a great question. And boy, that brought back memories. When I first started or decided to do the book, I was talking to a friend of mine at the National Association of Science Writers, which is, of course, a collection of people who cover mainstream science. And I had just stepped down as president of NASW, and he said to me, oh, thank goodness you're no longer going to be president of NASW if you're going to take on a wacko subject like this. And I laughed at the time, but what I finally ended up deciding was, there's no point in building up a whole lot of credibility, as I think I have over the years, without occasionally deciding to cash in those chips on an interesting idea. Right. And that's really was my decision, that I thought someone like me, years of upright mainstream journalism, was a really good person to tackle that issue, and that I could get away with doing it. And I did, actually. I'm back on the mainstream side with Toxicology and Poisoner's Handbook, but I did, I think, I don't want to say get away with it, but I think, because that sounds so, but successfully make people think about some really interesting ideas. And I'm very proud of that.
Yeah, let's pull that apart for a second, because, I mean, I was hearing that phrase, get away with it, you know, the whole time in my head. And it does seem, you know, you have, congratulations, right? But particularly in science journalism, it would seem that the taboo is even greater than it is for me. I mean, I come out of a background of feature writing, right? You know, I can say, well, I'm writing about human experience and I have a little bit of an out there. But as a science journalist, I mean, I guess you're expecting to have the same view as mainstream science, right?
And even more so, I mean, it was interesting to me that quite often when I was talking to scientists, you know, people would say, well, what are you working on now? I'd say, well, I'm doing a book on psychical research. And a lot of scientists were, that's a really interesting subject, and let me tell you about this, you know, A, B, or C. My journalism friends, my science journalism friends, were a little more freaked out, to my surprise. And I think that's partly because science journalism itself, you know, struggles for credibility in the science community. We're one of the favorite targets of scientists. And anyone who's been a journalist covering science knows that there's an ongoing tension between those of us who cover it, who are not necessarily covering it because we're writing from the fan club perspective, but because we're just trying to illuminate it, and people who work in science who don't always care for what we write. So science journalists, in an interesting way to me, proved to be even more conservative than scientists. And it made for some interesting challenges for my friends. That's I wouldn't deny that. You know, I'm a longtime investigative reporter, so the flip of that is, you know, it doesn't bother me to tick people off. So I was fine with it.
Yeah, let's get into that a little bit. I mean, what kind of reactions did you get? Because I noticed you're still... are you still on the advisory board for the World Federation of Science Journalists?
I am. So, you know, still mainstream. I think people were afraid. And this is a really interesting balancing act for someone like me, that if you step over into what a lot of my friends certainly saw as the dark side, that I would credulously believe every story told. And there were people who said that after I did the book. You know, the Skeptical Inquirer did a very polite job of saying they didn't believe that I had been quite skeptical enough. And Richard Dawkins did a less polite job of saying exactly the same thing. So there were people, there's a legitimate fear in an interesting way that if you start exploring this subject, it's going to be seductive and you're going to come out, you know, wearing your,
yeah.
And wearing a tin hat and all of those, you know.
That would make a great author photo, wouldn't it? On the book jacket with a tin hat?
Tin hat, that's right.
I'm curious, did you get the sense, looking at the Skeptical Inquirer review or Dawkins review, that they had looked into these, you know, looked into the society to the depth that you had looked into what William James had done and said, or his colleagues had researched? Did they have your level of knowledge about the subject?
No, I don't think they did, actually. I think that they had taken a look at some of the high-profile kind of statements or mediums or issues, but not really looked at the cohesive whole. And they certainly hadn't looked the way I had at sort of looking at the layers of the cake. I was looking at 19th century, very brilliant scientists, not just William James, but at the time it was socially permissible for, much more socially and culturally permissible for scientists to be involved with this. So you had Nobel laureates, you had, you know, some remarkably high-end researchers.
Would you go ahead and run down the cast for a second for us, Deborah?
Well, sure.
I mean, who else was involved?
Well, not just, you know, James, of course, was a founding member of the American Psychological Association and wrote, eventually became a pragmatist philosopher, but wrote the seminal textbook in this country, Principles of Philosophy, I mean, Psychology. But in addition, he was working with other philosophers, Henry Sidgwick, the famous utilitarian philosopher mm-hmm. from Great Britain. He worked with Charles Richer from France, who won the Nobel Prize for his work with anaphylaxis. He worked with John Strutt, Lord Rayleigh, who won the Nobel Prize for his work with atmospheric chemistry. Yes. He worked with Oliver Lodge, who preceded Marconi in establishing radio and wireless communication. He worked with, I mean, I have a long list of very exceptional scientists who were involved.
Not exactly a bunch of stiffs.
That's exactly right. So I don't think that the skeptics, you know, they tend to just say, oh, well, they were delusional, right? They stepped into the dark side the way everyone thought I was doing, and they became delusional. William Crookes, who discovered thallium, you know, people would actually say about him, he used to be a brilliant chemist, but now he's delusional.
Yeah.
And so they just have that knee-jerk reaction to it. But I was much more interested in saying, whoa, these are really smart people, and I want to dig way deep into figuring out what they found. And I wanted, and you'll see this in the book, to try to build their case. How does telepathy, the idea of telepathy, fit with the idea of communication with the dead? And, you know, where does one reinforce the other? And what is the evidence that kind of interlinks? So I know that I didn't see any of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's a couple of things I'm struck by in what you're saying, but before we press too far on into the content of the book, I want to just sort of set the foundation for this a little bit more. And you told me why professionally you felt brave enough, let's say, to go ahead and take this on. But why on a personal level were you interested in this? What led you to this topic?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, I actually came upon the idea when I was researching a previous book called Love at Goom Park, which is a history of psychology, love and affection. And I'm a horrible over-researcher. So in order to understand my 20th century story, I went way back to Descartes and all. And I was looking, as I worked my way through 19th century psychology, literally in the scientific journals of the late 1800s, you start seeing these real smacks at William James, right? Boy, you know, he's fallen into a swamp and he's going to take us all with. And I thought to myself, well, I didn't think William James, I mean, I didn't know William James was crazy. And also, I thought he was kind of, you know, a stiff, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, kind of an institution from the history of science. So I was very curious about that. And one day, and this is my kind of woo-woo moment, I guess, I was still kind of wondering about it. And I went to a used bookstore on one of the main streets that connects the University of Wisconsin, where I work with the kids downtown. And there on like a right about at eye level in their history of science stuff was William James, the book William James on Psychical Research. It was actually a first edition from the 1930s, and I went, whoa, I'm going to read that. And I bought that book, and in it was this amazing story of which is actually the start of the actual book, of a event William James researched in which a woman is able to solve the death and disappearance of a young girl in her dreams. Wow. And it's a phenomenal story. Mm-hmm. And I read that story and I thought, but what if that's real? Right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, that's what I thought, and wouldn't that be fascinating to just take a serious look at this period where you had great scientists and ask that question. That was my first. What if it's real? And then, if this is the best ghost hunt in the history of science, what did it find? And then my last question was, not just what is it real, but who gets to decide what's real, right?
Right.
The power of telling you what you can and cannot believe. And once I started thinking about those questions, I thought those are career-worthy questions, right?
Yep.
And ones that I wanted to try to answer, and off I went.
That's terrific. You know, I have to say I'm seeing such parallels between the time period you covered and even today, right? So you had mentioned how, you know, there became this sort of, oh, poor William, you know, he went over to the dark side kind of attitude toward William James, you know. And today, and I cover this in chapter two of my book, Brian Josephson, inventor of the Josephson Junction, Nobel Prize winner himself, quantum physicist, you know, bright, accomplished guy who does some parapsychological research and is a staunch advocate of psi and telepathy. And there are people who claim that, you know, he has run off the rails, that he is clearly now no longer worth listening to. And it's sort of struck me as I was reading the book how often there were these parallels between, you know, over a century ago and we're still in the same state today culturally that we were then.
I agree. I mean, and in some ways, I think we are completely in that same kind of knee-jerk reaction, you know, so that you start saying, well, what have we learned here, right? Haven't we at least learned to be a little more open-minded, or haven't we? I'm going to sound like I'm completely on the mainstream dark side here, but haven't we at least learned to understand that we're not always right,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And to be open-minded to possibilities. And that was really one of the messages, I think, like you, that I wanted to get out was, you know, the world's a lot more interesting than we allow it to be. And we need to be open-minded to alternative possibilities, at least open-minded.
Right? You know what I'm fascinated by is this push and pull between the scientific method, right, and the demands of the scientific method, and the materialist worldview, which mm-hmm. for, you know, the hardcore dogmatic materialists, they're one and the same thing, but they're really not the same thing at all. You know, the scientific method is unchanging, but our storehouse of knowledge changes constantly. And that's why it's so striking to me when people, out of a desire to sort of protect that current storehouse, shoot down anything that they consider threatening to it.
You know, one of the things that I've said to people is that, you know, I've taken something, well, let me back up a minute. So one of the issues that I really explore in my book is what it was called in the 19th century crisis apparitions, and
right.
are sometimes called death visitants today, and which is one of the most common sort of everyday supernatural paranormal experiences in which, you know, at the time of an unexpected death in another place, occurring for someone that you're connected to emotionally in some way, you have you see or hear or smell or feel some kind of apparition giving you a message, guys in my book went through tens of thousands of these, you know, proving that they happened hundreds of times above chance, and they fact-checked them, you know, is it a credible story? Is there documentary evidence? And still, you know, this is not stuck in mainstream science. And so I say to people, well, how would you prove it using current scientific method? You can't predict it, which is fundamental to science. You have to be able to predict. You can't develop a testable theory. How would you do that, right? Would you corral, you know, 100,000 people and then randomly kill their relatives to see if any of them have this experience? It doesn't fit into the scientific mainframe, and so we're stuck with this sort of disconnect between what people experience and our ability to measure how something is real. Am I making sense?
You sure are. Yeah, you anticipated my next question, actually. You're answering it now before I even asked it.
I'm so brilliant. I knew I should, of course, say I knew you were going to answer.
There you go, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay. That was the question. I mean, I was going to... Alex just had, and frequent listeners to Skeptico, maybe they listened to this podcast, but at the point that we're recording this, Alex's most recent guest was Andy Paquette, who made the observation that part of the problem with quantifying telepathy may be that it emerges most convincingly in this spontaneous sort of fashion when there aren't scientists around in lab coats, you know, observing it, mm-hmm. and no one's filming, and, you know, and it becomes, you know, an anecdote now. And,
right.
And what do we do with that? Right.
And you can collect them. I mean, like kind of have an observational statistical mass of them, right? Mm-hmm. Which is exactly what scientists tried to do in the time period I was writing about. You know, thousands and thousands of reports and careful statistical analysis. And we do use this kind of observational method in science, but again, the sort of catch is that we only accept those from kind of observational statistical analyses from people who are in the mainstream of science. So you could gather all of these observations together and still not be able to get them across. And I actually wrote, right after Ghost Hunters came out, I wrote a piece in the LA Times saying, you know, these are really interesting ideas, and we're 100 years smarter in terms of understanding methods of communication. And so why can't we get some incredibly Nobel, you know, the same kind of super smart group to tackle it from a modern day physics perspective? And as you can imagine, this did not turn out to be a call to action. You know, people wrote and they said, legitimately, and this is a hard, I don't have enough money for my research and I can hardly get funded. And where am I going to find, even if I wanted to do this, right? Mm-hmm. Where am I going to get the money? Who's going to support the research? What's going to happen to my career? And the example you gave, you've probably also looked at, the report that was published by Daryl Bim Cornell,
yeah.
Right? Which, and Daryl Bim's a long time, very accepted, you know, scientist in the realm of gender differences in psychology. You know, he got no traction on that whatsoever.
I'm impressed that he got enough traction to get it published, but in particular, I thought the New York Times article was almost comical in the way they sort of introduce it, and then, the topic, it's precognition research. I mean, for those who aren't familiar with it, Daryl Bim, Cornell University psychologist, did a study on precognition. And like all these studies, I mean, you know, after 1,000 trials, he ends up with statistics. He achieves statistical significance. It's a small but statistically significant effect. It's not the sort of thing that John Edwards could make his money off of.
Right.
Or any of these, you know, so-called big-name psychics. It's this much smaller effect, which you would think people would find less threatening. But in the Times article, they introduced this, and then they just had this murderer's row of people, including Ray Hyman, just tearing apart his research. And when I say tearing apart his research, that's giving them too much credit. They were just responding to the idea of it.
I agree. I absolutely agree. I read it, and I am not like an expert in statistical analysis. Mm-hmm. I mean, I read it and I thought, would I have picked precognition to study? Because to me, that one is one of the hardest cells, mm-hmm. right? Of all the supernatural ideas that the future is fixed and influences the present and the past, essentially the past, and that there are those of us who will be able to see the future, right? Mm-hmm. I look at it and I go, well, you know, that one, just by its nature, is unbelievably hard sell. Having said that, none of them, I love telepathy and still think that there's got to be some way to figure out how to explain that, but to give Daryl Bim credit, there's a century's worth of efforts to persuade mainstream science that there's something worth investigating in telepathy that have failed. So maybe it makes more sense to take something, you know, even more out there in some ways and try for that.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned not being an expert in statistics, right? Because I think one of the things we struggle with now, too, just as a population, is that we have the same relationship with science now that laity has traditionally had with the clergy, you know? And what am I to do as, a person who didn't specialize in statistics when I review a Daryl Bem paper, and then I see arguments between, let's go ahead and invoke the name of somebody like Jessica Otz, who, as far as I'm aware, hasn't weighed in on the paper yet, the Bem paper yet, but she's weighed in on a lot of telepathy research. And she's an expert in the field of statistics. And she'll be claiming on one side that this is all very rigorously done and handled and statistically sound in its analysis, and that there's something going on here. And then you've got people on the skeptical side saying, no, 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 it's not true. And we end up being thrown back again. And I think this is one of the hard things, you know, who do we believe? Who do we trust? I want to see somehow people in the middle pick this stuff up and look at it. But that's a very, very rare occurrence. You know, usually you have people doing the research, reviewing each other's research, or you have these, like I call them, the dogmatic skeptics on the other side. And so it's very hard to get to the bottom of a field in which these are the conditions.
I agree. And, you know, what's been interesting to me, and I like to tell people this, you know, like I said, I'm a mainstream science journalist and daughter of a chemist, right? I grew up in the sacred halls of science. And so, you know, I really am an admirer of much of the scientific system. But what was fascinating to me when I started working on Ghost Hunters is that up until the point that I started working on this book, I did not appreciate how many people have experienced these so-called supernatural events. I mean, so that once you as people who would never come up to, you know, Deborah the skeptical science writer, were suddenly people in my office, people at stores, mm-hmm. people say, what are you working on? Then they'd want to tell you. I'd go and give talks at different universities. I mean, literally, I was at a university in Florida talking about another book, and they said, what are you working on? And I said, well, this book about ghost hunting. And they said, oh, let us tell you about our haunted laboratory. Or I was at a meeting with a bunch of animal researchers, and I was sitting next to a very respected scientist from Stanford who immediately started telling me about the telepathic experiences she'd had with a friend of hers who's a scientist at a Southwestern university. And I thought to myself, this whole world exists that really those of us in, you know, the Dr. Skeptics community never see, because people just don't tell you that. And so it is. And so the other side of it is, from the mainstream science side, it's really difficult to measure the frequencies of this event because people don't share them.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, because you'd mentioned this earlier, that scientists had reacted in an open-minded fashion to the idea that you were going to write a book about this. But I'm curious, how many of the people who would qualify as scientists or academics who told you their stories or who expressed some measure of support for the book do you think would have been willing to be public about that?
None.
Yeah.
You know, and you notice I'm carefully protecting there, but none of them said, and please quote me, or I want to, you know, it's just right. Like, well, Deborah, between us, let me tell you this. Two most interesting experiences to that effect that I had. I was the National Academy of Sciences, which does a big lecture series called Distinctive Voices or something, out in their California facility, asked me to come out and give a talk about ghost hunters. And I went out, and you know, they'd sold the place out. There were like 1,000 people. And so I was talking about this crisis apparition thing, and I told a story that I actually tell in the book about an experience my father-in-law had, and compared it to some of the 19th century ones. And one of the women in the audience, an incredibly sharp group, said, well, I wonder how many people here have had this experience. So I just stopped the lecture. I said, everyone put up their hands if they've had an experience with a crisis apparition or know someone who has. And, you know, close to half the people in the room put up their hands. It was really phenomenal. On the same line, I talked about the book on Science Friday, the NPR show Science Friday. And again, you can see one of the great advantages for someone like me is I cash in all my credit chips, as I am a mainstream science writer, so that I do get invitations to talk about this in these very mainstream forums, right? Mm-hmm. But when I was on Science Friday, the host was an old and good friend of mine, Joe Palka. And Joe called me up the day before and said, I'm really worried about the show. We have this audience that I think isn't going to like your topic. So, of course, and I'm like, I sort of thought, thanks a lot, because I went on, you know, kind of a nervous wreck. They're all going to hate what I say. But that wasn't what happened. Instead, people came in and told their ghostly experiences, and I was fielding emails from other people who wanted to tell ghostly experiences. So in an interesting way, when you do a piece of work like this, it's a permission. It's like a permission slip for me.
I can't believe you just used that phrase. That's exactly how I've been thinking of my own book, is that I just think we live in a time right now when people do feel they need a permission slip in order to explore spirituality. And I think that's a shame, but I also understand it. Because, look, let's face it, science is making this conversation possible through Skype right now, right?
That's right.
And it makes sense for us to want to behave in a way that is scientifically responsible, but also gives us access to these sorts of spiritual experiences that I think people, a lot of people, let's put it that way, naturally have and or long for. And I had begun to think of Fringeology for me as, you know, it's like a 275-page permission slip.
I love that description. So, but yeah, that's exactly the term that came to my mind. It was like somehow I was giving people permission to tell these stories. And I felt on the other side like I had this permission slip to learn about a world I hadn't considered before, right? That had been closed to me because people wouldn't have talked to me the way they did.
Let's dive into one of the other interesting ideas in the book. Because I thought, and I don't want to give away too much detail, because I really admire how artfully you constructed the narrative, and I want people to discover it, you know, for themselves, right? And I hope they will. But there's a really poignant part of the book in which you discuss the fact that if there is life after death, if consciousness does continue in some form, and those are obviously big ifs, that the difficulty of developing evidence isn't just here on our side, potentially, but on the other side as well. It's a possibility raised in your book, you know, when...
Yes.
Right. Well, go ahead.
Well, you're thinking about the cross correspondence,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. When members of the Society for Psychical Research begin themselves to die, right, there's this sense that for reasons unknown to us, despite their desire with their, no longer beating hearts, to communicate with us, that they simply can't do so clearly and effectively once they've crossed to the other side. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. As I struggle with how to frame this, toward the end of my book, which spans, 30-odd years, or in its central story, some of the key members of this group of researchers die, and there's a great hope that these sort of trained psychical researchers, once they get to the other side, will be able to more effectively communicate with the living, because one of the great frustrations that people had felt, and I think people who work in this field still feel today, is that while things that appear to be messages in that they contain information that the medium couldn't know, say. They appear to be messages, but they're also often trivial or vague, or why, if you could finally get a message across from the other side, would you want to talk about a picture on the mantle, right? Mm-hmm. Those kind of things. So they set up this fantastic experiment in which they had mediums, really well-respected, non-professional. These were not performing mediums. These were mediums who worked strictly for research societies on three different continents. And what they would do is that they would go to a medium, say in Britain, and they would ask her to help talk with a spirit, and they would communicate in a way that that message would then be relayed to a medium in another country. And they did this in really interesting ways. They did it at one point by having the whole message done in a language, Latin, say, which the educated spirit in Britain would understand, but which the less educated American medium would not. Mm-hmm. And so the question was, you know, can you get a mess? Can you get a spirit to translate that to another medium? And some of these messages that came across, in fact, effectively did that. But there was a lot of frustration expressed by the spirits the mediums were talking to. Edward Gurney, Fred Myers, Richard Hodgson were the three. Fred Myers was a philosopher who had been long engaged with psychical research and written one of the most important books. Edmund Gurney had done some of the primary telepathy experiments and died mysteriously of a chloroform overdose. And Richard Hodgson, who had really been the driving force in research with the Americans, had dropped dead of a heart attack at a very young age. And so they were trying to connect all these spirits. And you get these things where the mediums are essentially taking notes on what the spirits are telling them, and the spirits are lecturing them. You know, why aren't you understanding what I have to say? Or don't you understand how difficult this is for me? Or I'm saying this and you are getting it wrong. And there was a lot of discussion, and in some of the research they did, this is a long answer, but I find it really fascinating, about when you're conveying a message telepathically, whether it's you know, living mind to living mind, or let's say dead mind to living mind, what are the barriers to getting that across? And I might think of it like this. I'm telepathically at this moment, Steve, sending you an image of a vase of flowers. Mm-hmm. So you get a picture in your mind of a vase of flowers. Now, I ask you right at this moment, What color are those flowers?
I'd seen red and yellow.
Okay. And I was seeing purple lilac, right? Because that's my favorite flower here in Wisconsin. And so the lilac. And so so you have this problem where I'm sending you flowers, but your brain is going to translate that into your known experience, right? Right. And so why would that be different if you're communicating as a dead person with a living person, plus you're communicating against layers and layers of barriers? So in that game of telepathic pass it on, you know, the odds of, or this was certainly the theory they were working with, the odds of that message being altered mind to mind, the way we do it even in conversations with each other, right? You make assumptions about what's in the other person's mind. It is a great way of looking at why this would be so challenging. And you know, one of the questions that I think I would love to actually see addressed well is, what's the pattern of things that we know get really pushed through, right? Mm-hmm. And what makes them similar? And is there something that tells us? And at this point, I'm going to sound like this would be me thinking as someone who would be interested in telepathically, in researching telepathy. But if you could look at what are the things that consistently people get across
successfully.
Yes. Then you might say, well, why would that be? Why do we always see, for instance, to go on one more minute, I actually did a telepathy experiment at the American Society for Psychical Research, which I found peculiar. I would like let myself be part of an experiment, which completely unnerved me. But one of the things they said to me is that the color red is one of the hardest colors they found to transmit telepathically. And they had an experiment in which someone who was an experienced sender was trying to send the color red to a receiver, and he knew that red was a hard color to transmit. I don't know why. And so he tried to think of an image of something incredibly red, and he had this idea of flaming red fire, right? Mm-hmm. And the person he was sending it to had a box of matches in his pocket and leapt out of his chair screaming that his pants were on fire. now, it's a great story, right?
Yeah, right, right.
But then you go back to say, well, why would red be hard to send? And I think I one of the things I've always wanted to see is a really good breakdown of what messages got through and why. Why do people think those are, you know, the stronger messages? And I really think that that's why if you could integrate, I know I'm saying good science isn't a complete match, but some of that scientific method done well, I think might find some really interesting patterns that we've yet to find.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting to me is I'm imagining somebody listening to this conversation, right, who is of that more dogmatic, skeptical mindset. And I would expect to them that we might sound like we're just two believers chatting over the fence. But I get the sense from you in the couple of conversations we had and reading the book, and I know for myself, it's not that I'm in any way anti-science or looking for less science. I'm calling for more science, and I get right. the sense that you are too. This is just stuff that we should study some more.
That's exactly what I think, you know, and I think these are really fascinating questions. And sometimes, you know, people will come up to me and they'll say, well, do you believe in ghosts? And I said, well, I don't think that's the interesting question. I think the question is, why do we see them?
Yeah.
Because we do.
Yeah.
And if we could understand why we see them, right, then we would understand ourselves and our world much better.
Right.
And instead of just saying, oh, well, all of the thousands of people who claim to have seen a ghost or believe they've seen a ghost or had this experience or whatever, or just, you know, like I said, loons walking on the tin head side of the street. Instead of saying that, if you would say, well, let's try to figure that out, because whether we just prove that there's, you know, we're prone to hallucination, you know, on right. the very skeptical side, or whether we prove that there's really some interesting natural laws that we just haven't figured out yet, we would allow the world to be a more interesting place. And that is why I think you and I are exactly on the same page on this. We need more research, not less.
Now, let's move away from science for a second to a field, in a sense, we both know better, and we'll sort of push to the end here with this. The journalism, right? Just the practice of journalism. I find it deeply ironic that paranormal topics, and now you have a very a narrow focus within your book on this group of people and this, you know, this formation of society. And in mine, I get into UFOs and telepathy and ghosts and issues of spirituality, like meditation and this sort of thing. And what's intriguing to me is that in journalism, these sorts of topics, anything that could be ascribed to the paranormal, are considered fluff or color pieces. But when you think about it, these issues cut straight to the heart of what it means to be human. These are the profound existential questions we get caught up in at births, at death, and deaths, you know, at funerals and baptism. Who are we? Why are we here? What happens, if anything, when we die? Is there a God? Are we alone in the universe? And isn't it funny that for some reason we treat these topics as funny?
Yes. And you know, that is a fascinating question, because these are the really big ideas, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you and I think this makes me sound like the world's greatest ego head, but in raising this point, we are raising, we're thinking like a William James, because that's what he said. He said, you know, the big risk you run by he said two things that I think are so relevant still today. One is that the big risk that you run when you dogmatically just deny an area of inquiry is that you close yourself up from the possibility of a much more amazing universe than we know. And the other thing he said was that that if science doesn't care about the things that really matter to people, people won't care about science.
Right.
And I think both of those points are true.
Yeah, I came across a study recently, and I'm not going to be able to quote it directly. It's referenced in the book, but there's a study recently in which it was determined that where paranormal claims are concerned, if science rejects them, people are more likely to accept them as true. The subjects of this study.
Oh, that's interesting.
Psychological study, yeah. Well, look, you know, the other part of this that I find funny as a journalist is that in terms of the material we work with, right, our bricks and mortar are scenes and anecdotes and colorful details. And so it's also ironic to me that more journalists don't write stories about these sorts of events because, man, you know, you probably have used the phrase a lot, low-hanging fruit. Like a certain story is just so easy to get. It's just sort of sitting there right there for you. It's low-hanging fruit. Well, man, where these topics are concerned, this stuff is priceless. I had a gas spending a year, you know, reporting on these colorful, outlandish kinds of stories. And I had the same sense reading Ghost Hunters that you were just traipsing through all this and really enjoying the landscape and the scenery. Is that true?
I did. I had a wonderful time. I can't tell you that. And, you know, lots of people who thought I was going to, like, end up as a wing nut really liked the book. But I didn't recruit anyone to it, Steve, right? None of my friends said, wow, that was a fascinating book. Now I think I'll explore that. And I think they miss a lot.
Right. Yeah, well, I just think that it's so much easier to continue doing what you're doing if you're successful in your career. I think that for any journalist, it's just so much easier to stick with that.
Did your book's coming out in June, right?
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to it. Did you find that your journalism friends were afraid you were going to be a tin hat kind of guy?
I get the hairy eyeball every time I bring it up, and it's been really,
So you and I are pioneers, right? Because like me, you're going to do a national I think mine's fascinating, so I'm good. But a national book about a fascinating subject, and it's not going to make your career less. It's going to make it stronger. And there's a why am I blanking on the name of this book? Is it Stacy Horn? Do you know the book I mean?
Yeah.
Who she wrote the book about J.B. Rhine, in which she also ended up saying, "But I can't explain this away," right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we're like the start of a big trend.
Well, you know,
which would be good.
You do wonder, right, if at some point this stuff is going to change, because I actually perceive more common ground now. I mean, the irony of all this, right, is at this time when the debate is as hot seemingly as it's ever been between believers and skeptics, you've got people like, say, an Andy Newberg or Stephen LaBerge, the lucid dreaming expert, who, and Newberg is the guy who studies the neural correlates of religious experience, and he's been exploring meditation and contemplative prayer. And these are mystic practices carried on for millennia that science has just now caught up to and realized why they're powerful and why they can be, that they in fact exist, they're real, and they can be beneficial. And so there's, right there are some spiritual practices people can take up and have that permission slip signed and replicated by science. And yet, in a larger cultural sense, you know, look, in our business, the way to approach a story about religion and science is going to be with some sensational headline, "Can they coexist?" Or "The war between religion and science." And I'm not sure how accurate that really is.
I agree. And I do think, you know, no one argues that daily journalism is an in-depth enterprise, right? And so all of us suffer from, you know, the overall superficial approach. And I would hope that eventually this collected body of work and the continued interest is actually going to move us forward. I really do sincerely hope that.
Real quick, the book you mentioned, Stacy Horn, the title is unbelievable for anyone who's interested in that. It really is a terrific book. And I just want to close by asking you a couple more quick questions. How have you been regarded by colleagues since this book came out? I mean, do you feel like any relationship was strained by this and has remained so? Or you've got away clean?
I would like to think that I got away clean. I don't think it's hurt me. I think it made me more interesting. It made me a more interesting writer. People come up to me still and say, I love that book. And now that I'm running around doing Poisoner's Handbook, mm-hmm. a lot of times if I do book signings afterwards at a talk, I just gave one in Canada, they always have, you know, the previous book, which is Ghost Hunters. People buy it instead of the Poison book. They go, that's a fascinating subject. I want to know something about it. So, clean is the wrong word. I think, you know, I'm a little smudgy in that I'm still interested in it, but I don't mind that.
Yeah. And then the last question I'm going to ask you is, going forward, right, what advice would you have for the field of science journalism about covering a topic that might have that kind of paranormal taint about it, right? In terms of when to do it and how to do it. If you were an editor and you had a reporter doing a story on the Daryl Bem research, for instance, would you have any particular marching orders for them? Or are there things you'd be alert for? Or?
Well, I wouldn't. I mean, I think it's a mistake to decide what the story is in advance. And I think far too many, if we take the Daryl Bem study, saw it in advance as an opportunity for comedy. Whereas I think it's much more interesting, especially when you're looking at a scientist like Daryl Bem, and he's different because he does have this long mainstream, to frame it into the why did he do it, right?
Right.
So that it's, because to me that allows you to really explore the science itself in a more interesting way. And I think one of the things, and certainly this is true of all of my work, from Monkey Wars, which was on primate research, to Poisoner's Handbook, that I think that it's really important for people who cover science to remember is that science itself, just like science journalism, is a really human enterprise. And it's always stories of people trying to explain and figure out the world around us. And just because that's what science does. And just because someone is trying to explain and figure out the world around us in a less than traditional way doesn't mean that their question isn't an interesting question. I think that we miss a lot of really good stories and information, and that science misses the opportunity to ask some really interesting questions when we keep the path too narrow.
Fantastic. That's a great place to end. Thank you, Deborah Blum, and I'm Steve Volk, and thanks to Alex Sakaris for letting me contribute this podcast to Skeptico. Deborah Blum, her current book is The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York, but of course the one you're going to go get is Ghost Hunters. And thanks, Deborah.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And a special thanks to Steve Volk for producing this podcast today. And of course, thanks again to Deborah Blum for joining us today. If you'd like more information about this show, including links to all our previous shows, please visit the Skeptico website. It's at skeptiko.com. You'll also find a link to our forum where you can chat with others about this show, an email, Facebook link to me, as well as some other links you may find interesting. I have a number of very interesting interviews coming up. Stuart Hameroff is joining us, as is Rupert Sheldrick, and several other guests as well. Just more shows than I can possibly get to, but I will get to them, and I'll get them all out to you, because that's what I love to do here at Skeptico. Please keep Skeptico in mind when you're out there blogging, chatting, forum posting, whatever. I want to introduce as many people as we can to the show. That'll do it for today. Until next time, bye for now.